Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. On the second day of the trial of the WikiLeaks leaker, we will begin with a retired CIA officer turned political activist, Ray McGovern, and discuss who should be on trial with Private Bradley Manning. One of the driving forces behind the creation of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, formed to expose the falsification of intelligence to justify the Iraq War, Ray McGovern has an article at antiwar.com, The Moral Imperative of Bradley Manning. Then we will speak with Chase Madar, the author of a new book, The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story behind the WikiLeaks whistleblower, and look into who Bradley Manning is and why he did what he did, as well as discuss the government's treatment of the Army private who has been held without trial for 3 years, often in unusually harsh conditions. We will also discuss Chase Madar's article at The Nation, Seven Myths About Bradley Manning. Then finally, following today's introduction in the Rose Garden by President Obama of 3 judges the Republicans are likely to filibuster, we will speak with a longtime Democratic strategist, Carrie Wofford, who recently served Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid running an in-house think tank for Democratic senators. We will discuss why it has taken so long for the Democrats to push back against the usurpation of power by the Republicans' consistent use of the filibuster, and whether majority rule will return to the Senate. Joining us now is Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under 7 U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. He currently leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. In 2003, he helped create Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war on Iraq. His latest article at antiwar.com is The Moral Imperative of Bradley Manning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ray McGovern.
Thank you, Ian.
And your article suggests a sort of almost a martyrdom going on here that is reminiscent in many ways of the prophet Jesus, in the sense the book, by the way, that's following you is called The Passion of Bradley Manning, which is I think an overt reference to that. And in that context, it may be a little overblown, but is the U.S. military the Romans in this case?
Well, I believe the whole Department of Defense should be on the dock, so to speak, that and the media. What we saw in that collateral murder video that was released, which was unclassified, by the way, was gun barrel photography with sound of the murder, really, the shooting to death of 12 Iraqi civilians. Now, I draw a distinction here. There are rules of engagement which, by some stretch, could be used to, quote, justify, end quote, this shooting. The key point being that two of these individuals, Reuters people, one had a camera that could have looked like a gun from far away. Anyhow, they were all killed. But next came a Good Samaritan, a father driving two of his children to school, and he happens upon one of the Reuters employees who had not yet died. He was struggling to get up from the street onto the sidewalk. He was badly wounded. What does the Good Samaritan do? He stops. What does he do? He gets some neighbors, and they start to carry this man into the van so that he can be brought to medical attention. What do the Apache helicopter pilots and shooters do? Give us permission to shoot. Permission. We need permission to shoot. There are people rescuing this man, and they're insistent in asking for permission. Finally, it's granted, and we see right before our eyes 6 straight volleys or salvos of shots that kill the father, wound the children very badly. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because that is pure and simple a war crime. Whatever you do to justify the earlier shootings, shooting at people rescuing the wounded is, by definition, a war crime. Now, what did the Department of Defense say? Well, they said that was all because of the rule. All in accordance with the rules of engagement. The Secretary of Defense said that. Well, if the rules of engagement include war crimes like this, we've got a real problem. And that is what went viral. That video went viral, not so much in this country, but around the world. And it's ironic that the best little segment, sort of 60-minute type segment that's available on this, comes from Panorama, the German 60 Minutes type program. And it's available. All you need to do is go up on your URL and put Shooters Walk Free, and you'll be amazed at 12 minutes of the video gun barrel photography, plus some context to put it in.
Well, I believe it was the video, watching the video, Bradley Manning watching the video, even though he says that he's seen a lot of what he called war porn, this was the straw that broke the camel's back for him. And, of course, he's the reason why we've seen this video. And as you pointed out, it wasn't even classified in the first place. Clearly, and in the case of the children that were shot and the father who was killed, the people in the Apache helicopter, when they found out, they said, you shouldn't bring kids to a war zone. You, in your article, you conclude at antiwar.com, you conclude, Ray McGovern, by saying, if there's a God of justice, and I believe there is, we run the risk of forfeiting that blessing unless and until we stop. This is the blessing that presidents routinely say, God bless the United States. If there is a God of justice, and I believe there is, we run the risk of forfeiting that blessing unless and until we stop playing the role of violence-prone Cain. That is, if we fail to recognize, as Bradley Manning did, the mandate to be keepers, not oppressors, of our brothers and sisters. God will not be mocked or fooled by flag waving. So do you think that this trial in any way will give us an opportunity to have what we haven't had so far, which is a truth and reconciliation inquiry into the Iraq war? The British did one. No such thing here in the United States. The neocons are still out there as though nothing has happened, on television all the time. In fact, they're trying to sell a war with Syria at the moment. So where is the justice in the broader sense here in the United States?
Well, the justice is lost by undue emphasis on less important laws. Now, we all, that is, me included, we all sign a little secrecy agreement when we ask for access to classified documents. That's a promise. It's a promise to keep stuff secret that could endanger the national security. Now, are promises important? Of course they are. But, you know, everything is relative in a scheme of ethics here. And when the choice is between honoring a promise not to reveal secrets and to try to expose what's happening in a god-awful war, in an attempt to give people the wherewithal so that they can know what's happening, so they can debate it with full knowledge, well, the ethicists have a word for that. They call that a supervening value, okay? A value that is worth more, frankly, than the signature you put on a piece of paper to keep a secrecy promise. And so I think that when people realize the scope of what happened in Iraq, and that this is just a microcosmic insight into it, and when people, I hope, get a sense of what Bradley Manning felt, it wasn't only watching this collateral murder video. Even before that, he had the duty of walking around that part of Baghdad, making sure bad things weren't happening. And he watched people his age, 22 years old at the time, being wrapped up by Iraqi U.S.-trained security folks. Why? For writing a term paper that was mildly critical of the Maliki government. What happened to these young people? They're thrown into jails. What happens in those jails? Torture, pure and simple torture. Manning knew that. Manning knew that, and so did his superiors. When Manning said, hey, we can't be a part of this. We got to stop that. They said, shut up, go home, keep your mouth shut, okay? So he goes back to his barracks and he says, I wonder what I should do. Should I keep my mouth shut like everybody else does, or do I have a conscience? Do I want to stop this? The key here, Ian, in my view, is personal encounter with innocent suffering. He saw it in person in the streets of Baghdad. He saw it in this collateral murder video, and he saw it in countless other emails and other documents, cables from the Army and from the State Department, and he had a choice. He had a choice, the easy way out, and the way I took during Vietnam was, well, it's classified, it's classified. I don't want to risk my career or my mortgage or my children's education or my job or anything like that. Well, Bradley Manning, much younger than I was at the time, did the right thing. He said, look, I'm going to take a risk, but the risk is worth it because somehow the American people need to know what's really going on here. Last thing I'll say is that this was part of the surge. Now, people still contend that the surge turned the tide of war in Iraq. Well, all the surge did was stop the war at a point where George Bush and Dick Cheney could ride off into the western sunset not having lost a war. What did the surge cost? 950 U.S. military people dead. How many thousands of Iraqis? We don't know. What was the real effect of the surge? The main effect was to turn Baghdad, a city of 5 to 6 million people, from a predominantly Sunni, city into a predominantly Shia city. We could watch the lights go out in the old Sunni neighborhoods on satellite photography. It was a cleansing. It was an ethnic cleansing of Baghdad. And did that tamp down the violence for long enough for these chaps to go off into the western sunset? Yes, it did. So that's what the surge was all about. And the reason I mention that, of course, is that July 12th, 2007, was right in the middle of this surge. And we get a little insight into the bloodthirsty nature in which the people that we send into war. And, it's really, when you talk about brutalizing Iraqis, well, sure, you can see that in the film. But brutalizing our own young men, you hear that in the film. Mm. It's their own fault. They shouldn't bring children to the battlefield. They ran over that guy. Great, neat. Yeah. Okay, let us shoot. Now, pick up a weapon. They implore at a mile away in the skies. They implore this poor fellow who's trying to get up on the sidewalk. They go, pick up a weapon, will you? You know why? Because then the rules of engagement will allow them to shoot him into smithereens. He wouldn't pick up a weapon. He couldn't even get on the sidewalk. And that's the guy these people were trying to take care of.
And, of course, Ray McGovern, we've seen General Petraeus being elevated to a godlike stature. Obviously, his real contribution was to save Bush and Cheney's bacon, as you've pointed out. And now, of course, Iraq is very much in Iran's pocket. We just learned that the winner of the Iraq war in terms of liberating Iraq's oil is China. Now half of Iraq's oil goes to China. So there's been no reckoning. And my sense is that Cheney and Bush should be in the dock with Bradley Manning. In fact, when are we going to have a reckoning here of what they've done and what they've done to the United States and to our position in the world?
Well, the sooner the better. And this might help. But the fly in the ointment here, Ian, and no offense, of course, with your show, but the major media here are full-scale accomplices in disguising what went on. And there's a microcosmic insight into that in what the WikiLeaks revealed with respect to that terrible incident on the 12th of July, 2007. Guess what? Bradley Manning, as he recounts what happened, when he saw that video and he tried to research it, well, he found out, whoops, there's a Washington Post reporter here. He's embedded with this unit. His name is David Finkel. Oh, what did he say? Oh, he says that, there was a death of an American soldier, and so this was justified as payback for an earlier attack somewhere else. Oh, wow. Looks like he has access to this video. And he did have access. And what did he end up doing? He ended up writing a book. And you know what the book was? Quote, The Good Soldiers, end quote. writing about this unit that was doing these things. So there's an insight into how embedded means embed with, okay? And you get a very distinguished Washington Post reporter who sees these same things in the same video, comes to a different conclusion, completely prescinds from the moral implications here, takes the story that other Americans had been shot earlier that day or something like that, and then characterizes these folks as, quote, the good soldiers, end quote. That is emblematic of what has become to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and the rest of them. So it's up to people like you, Ian, and other people who have some sort of a right to be heard, to take this information from Bradley Manning and to get it out there. And again, one of the most powerful instruments is go up into your URL and say, shooters walk free, and you'll get a 12-minute in English, undubbed version of this panorama special, which puts context around exactly what happened, plus the more salient of the footage of this photography.
Well, Ray McGovern, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, you're most welcome, Ian. It's good to be back with you.
Again, I've been speaking with Ray McGovern, a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He served under 7 U.S. presidents over 27 years, presenting the morning intelligence briefings at the White House for many of them. He currently leads the Speaking Truth to Power section of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior in inner city Washington. And in 2003, he helped create Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity to expose the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war in Iraq. His latest article at antiwar.com is The Moral Imperative of Bradley Manning. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of The Passion of Bradley Manning.
So think you can stand with a stick, free Teflon, whitewash presidency. We're sick of being jerked around. Your blessings. We're sick of being checked around. We all fall down.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Chase Madar, who is a human rights attorney in New York, where he specializes in youth law, LGBT law, and disability law. He reports and reviews for the London Review of Books, Le Monde Diplomatique, Counterpunch, and Al Jazeera. His latest book just out is The Passion of Bradley Manning, the story behind the WikiLeaks whistleblower. And his latest article at The Nation is 7 Myths About Bradley Manning. Welcome to Background Briefing, Chase Madar.
Thanks so much for having me on your wonderful show.
Well, thank you, Chase. And The Passion of Bradley Manning, give me a sense of where that title came from. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think anyone who has suffered and put their body and their mind on the line to get some truth across deserves a book like this. I mean, it's really one of the most hackneyed title formulas around. If you look up on Amazon or any library card catalog, you will find The Passion of Martin Scorsese, The Passion of Tiger Woods. I'm proud to say The Passion of Bradley Manning is currently outselling The Passion of Ayn Rand online. And I'm not trying to step on anybody's religious toes here or out to offend, but I do see Bradley Manning as a secular martyr, as a tragic hero of the Enlightenment who is trying to bring reason and critical thought to the bloody mess of U.S. foreign policy. And I think bloody mess is putting it gently. If you look at the disaster after disaster of the past dozen years of American statecraft.
So if one were to use the analogy of the Passion of Christ and his crucifixion, then would the United States military be the Romans?
I don't think you're stretching the metaphor very much by saying that.
Well, but as a lawyer, Chase, it's pretty clear, isn't it, that when you're in the military, you sign away your life. You're not a civilian anymore. There's a fundamental difference, isn't there, between military law and civilian law?
That's true. You do lose certain rights. That doesn't mean that you turn off your brain and become completely obedient. In fact, there's a military theorist who talks about liberal obedience. She teaches at a wonderful little liberal arts college in the Hudson Valley, scenic place, by the name of West Point. And even there, they grant some autonomy or believe that, soldiers, even privates, should have some moral autonomy. There's a long tradition in the U.S. military of whistleblowers and truth-tellers and people refusing to obey illegal orders. This is not something that just started recently, and Bradley Manning is very much part of that tradition. Now, there's no doubt that he violated some military regulations. That's been pretty clear from the start in declassifying these documents without the proper authorization. And yet I think it's a very good thing that he did so. We need to know what our government is doing. We have inflicted immense destruction and carnage overseas in Iraq and in Afghanistan, in large part because of government secrecy, distortion, and lies. We've also paid a heavy price ourselves in blood and money because of government secrecy, distortion, and lies. These leaks provide the kind of adult public supervision that our foreign policy elites so badly need.
But do you feel, as others do, Chase Madar, that Dick Cheney and George Bush and Rumsfeld and Rice et al., Feith, Wolfowitz, they should be in the dock?
Well, I think what they did was absolutely evil. Even though I'm a lawyer, I have a hard time adopting these legalistic fantasies of imagining trying Dick Cheney and W. Bush and Condi Rice for war crimes, because it's never going to happen. I look at it in a more political sense. If in a just world, I think, yeah, they would be in the dock. I think they would be the ones being prosecuted for the horrible destruction and chaos and carnage that they have sown. Bradley Manning has done none of this, but he's taking the fall in the way for the past decade of disastrous foreign policy, the past decade of hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties and 4,500 Americans dead in Iraq and close to 2,000 in Afghanistan. It's just disgusting that the CIA torturers and none of Bush's war cabinet have paid any price, and yet the young private who brought some truth to light is the only one being prosecuted.
And again, I'm speaking with Chase Madar, a human rights attorney in New York, where he specializes in youth law, LGBT law, and disability law. He reports and reviews for the London Review of Books, Le Monde Diplomatique, Counterpunch, and Al Jazeera. And his latest book just out is The Passion of Bradley Manning, The Story Behind the WikiLeaks Whistleblower. And his latest article at The Nation is Seven Myths About Bradley Manning. And, you know, the British did have an official inquiry into the Iraq War and its origins, and the United States has never had any reflection on what happened, this, you know, monstrously destructive war that Iran has won and China has won the oil. On every level, it's very difficult to see anything but a complete disaster for the United States and an ongoing disaster, and particularly for Iraq, which is a broken country. So will this trial in any way, as much as the government doesn't want to discuss the war itself, just the, in effect, it's a contract dispute, I take it, in the legal sense that Bradley Manning violated his contract of secrecy, but do you think that through the cracks there'll be any kind of referendum on the war itself?
Unfortunately, not in the mainstream media. I mean, looking at the headlines from the past couple days, Manning's court-martial just began yesterday, June 3rd. You see the media grasping, trying to pin Bradley Manning on bin Laden, claiming and swallowing a lot of the prosecution's line that Bradley Manning helped Osama bin Laden because there were some WikiLeaks material found on Osama bin Laden's laptop. It's a bit like saying that Nike Shoes Corporation aided the enemy if they found a pair of vintage Air Jordans in bin Laden's closet. I mean, anyone in the world who had access to the Internet had access to these files and to these documents. I do think this trial was properly viewed as the pathetic and ugly final chapter in the whole ugly, sordid business of the Iraq War, a war that we rushed into disastrously in large part because of government secrecy, distortion, and lies, and is now closing with the prosecution of a truth teller and a court martial being conducted behind a very thick wall of more government secrecy distortion.
So just rather than repeat your article at The Nation, Jace Madar, Seven Myths About Bradley Manning, can you quickly sketch them out for our audience?
Okay, I'm trying to remember what I wrote yesterday. The first myth is that Manning leaked what he did because he's crazy and antisocial, or because he's gay, or because he's crazy and gay. This is the typical smearing of any whistleblower or political dissenter. It's the kind of thing that happened in the Soviet Union, where political dissenters were locked up in psychiatric hospitals. It's the kind of thing that the Nixon administration tried to do unsuccessfully to Daniel Ellsberg 40 years ago, when they sent their goons to break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to dig up dirt on him. Manning's motives were political. He wrote very clearly that he thought people should see the truth no matter who they are, because without knowledge, you cannot make well-informed decisions as a public. And he hoped that his leaks would lead to, quote, worldwide debates, discussions, and reforms. Now, people are, of course, free to disagree about the consequences of the leaks, but the motive is very plainly stated. And, you know, Ian, we're a very depoliticized society, and that's why we have a hard time digesting this political motive. Instead, we rush to find or interpret a psychological motive, a sexual motive. This is how we pathologize and marginalize whistleblowers.
A couple of the other points you make are that WikiLeaks and Bradley Manning are utopian, and that WikiLeaks is anti-American.
Yeah, this is something that's been missing in nearly all of the media coverage, the belief that Bradley Manning and WikiLeaks are utopian extremists. And in educated English, there's really no filthier curse word than to call someone utopian. I mean, that's like calling someone a naive, extremist, homicidal idiot. But who's utopian here and who's extreme? What Bradley Manning leaked is less than 1% of what Washington classifies in a given year. The real extremist in this picture is Washington, with its cult of secrecy and its really runaway problem of overclassification. This is something that's widely acknowledged even by political officials who are not particularly sympathetic to Manning or to WikiLeaks. But we are classifying 92 million documents a year now, and it should be no wonder that the public decisions that we make, especially regarding war and foreign policy, are poorly informed and result in catastrophe. I mean, it's also a myth that these people are anti-American. I think Bradley Manning did what he did out of a deep sense of patriotic duty. He's neck deep as a young army private in Iraq and in the worst foreign policy disaster since Vietnam. And he thinks people should know what's actually happening there, because God knows we're not getting very good reports or very critical reports from our media, and certainly not from the government. And if you read WikiLeaks' mission statement, you don't find any anti-American cliches at all. They quote Thomas Jefferson. They quote U.S. Supreme Court decisions. It's a funny kind of anti-Americanism. This is just another cheap way to smear these people who have done a great public service to the world, and above all to the United States.
And one of the other myths that you talk about, which has certainly been discussed a lot, is that Manning's leaks got people killed and damaged U.S. national security and national interests.
And this is really the most toxic myth. These accusations that WikiLeaks and Private Manning have blood on their hands. You know, the same people who are throwing this around are the U.S. government officials who led the way into Iraq and who kept us in Afghanistan and escalated the war there. It's very, Ian, I'll confess I'm a bit literal-minded, but I think what really has gotten people killed and put lives at risk is the act of war. It's invading Iraq, not telling the truth about the invasion and occupation of Iraq. It's escalating our war in Afghanistan, not telling the truth about how this war has actually been conducted. So far, there is not a shred of credible evidence of a single civilian or soldier being harmed because of WikiLeaks or Bradley Manning's leaks at all. This is a weird kind of externalization of guilt, you could say. I think the people who really have blood on their hands are Bradley Manning's accusers in the U.S. government, military, and media, for that matter.
And again, I'm speaking with Chase Madar, the author of the new book just out, The Passion of Bradley Manning, The Story Behind the WikiLeaks Whistleblower. He also has an article at The Nation, Seven Myths About Bradley Manning. Now, there's no question that he is, Bradley Manning has been mistreated by the military initially when he was in country in Iraq. They put him in a cage like an animal. They've kept him in custody for 3 years in solitary confinement, so much so that the judge, a U.S. judge, intervened and called it cruel and inhuman treatment. I'd be curious to know how one could compare the treatment that Bradley Manning has got at the hands, particularly of the Marines. I believe when he went to Leavenworth, the Army eased up a bit. But it'd be interesting to know about how, for example, the Marine who killed that entire extended family of Afghans in a rampage, he just went out one morning and just shot up a whole, I think 11 Afghans were killed. Do you know anything about how he's being treated compared to how Bradley Manning's being treated?
Yeah, Robert Bales, who's the Marine from my home state of Ohio, who went on a shooting spree and killed many Afghan civilians, he's kind of the exception in that the military is actually prosecuting him aggressively. They're even seeking the death penalty. But he was not placed in solitary confinement, and he was not tortured the way Bradley Manning was for the first 11 months of his confinement. What's very instructive, though, is just how lax the response in the military is to the killing and the shooting of most civilians in wartime, especially in our recent wars. If you look at the Haditha massacre, where a Marine unit shot very cold blood a group of civilians clustered in a home, execution style, nobody in this Marine Corps unit suffered much punishment at all. Only one of them was ultimately convicted of anything, and that was just negligence in the course of duty. But he did not do any jail time. Military law is incredibly forgiving and infinitely accommodating when it comes to rape, when it comes to sexual assault, when it comes to shooting foreign civilians dead. On the other hand, there's this fantasy that the whole house of cards and the whole legal system in the military and military discipline will collapse if there is any kind of even slight flexibility for Bradley Manning. It's just perverse. If someone breaks the law in a way that is socially productive, then the law needs to be flexible. That's why we have pardons and commutations. Pretty much any legal system around the world does. On the other hand, when there is rape and murder, the law needs to be much stricter than it is now. But that just shows what a mess military justice is. As somebody said, military law is to law what military music is to music.
Well, just in closing, in the trial today, apparently Adrian Lamo, the hacker, who I believe was the snitch, if you will, the FBI, while they had him in custody, or he's apparently has a fairly extensive record of hacking into major corporations like Yahoo, the New York Times, Microsoft. But when the FBI caught him, they let him communicate with Bradley Manning. So both the prosecution and the defense had a go at Lamo, who quoted Bradley Manning as saying essentially that he called himself a broken soul. What do you make of that?
Oh, and this is Lamo describing Manning as a broken soul?
No, as Manning describing himself as a broken soul in communicating with Lamo. I mean, if you can believe anything that Lamo says,
yeah, if you can
given
believe
that he's
anything
a snitch.
That, you know, I wouldn't read too much of that. Most 22-year-olds from the United States or in the United States are rather dramatic. I mean, adolescence lasts a good long time here. So I think this is the way a lot of people in their early 20s or late teens talk. I don't think Bradley Manning is a broken soul. This, I think he's a great soul, and I think he has performed a very noble service to the United States, not just as a matter of high principles and high-mindedness, but as a very practical matter. The knowledge that we have, thanks to these leaks, is deeply enriched our understanding of what our government is doing, how our wars have really been, and they make it much more possible with this knowledge that we will avoid further disasters like the Iraq War and like the ongoing Afghan War. Poor Adrian Lamo, a lot of people hate him, the informant who turned in Bradley Manning. Certainly don't find him very appealing, but I find him to be a deeply pathetic figure. I mean, this computer hacker, revered as kind of a genius in hacker circles, but if you're outside those circles, he looks like pretty much every other police informant, a convicted felon with a history of mental illness and some major issues.
Well, let me just say that I personally have no sympathy for hackers, because I'm at this very moment, my website, ianmaster.com, has been attacked for the last few days.
Oh, dear.
And severely attacked by a sophisticated onslaught, and we don't know where it's coming from. So I'd be the last person in the world to have any sympathy for hackers. Chase, we thank you very much for your book and for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Chase Madar, who is a human rights attorney in New York, where he specializes in youth law, LGBT law, and disability law. He reports and reviews for the London Review of Books, Le Monde Diplomatique, Counterpunch, and Al Jazeera. And his latest book just out is The Passion of Bradley Manning, The Story Behind the WikiLeaks Whistleblower. And his latest article at The Nation is Seven Myths About Bradley Manning. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the Rose Garden ceremony today, where the president presented three judicial nominees the Republicans are likely to yet again filibuster. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carrie Wofford, who's a Democratic strategist with 20 years of policy and political experience from White House campaigns and senior Capitol Hill posts. Until 2013, Wofford served Chairman Tom Harkin of the United States Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions as the senior committee counsel. She was awarded the 2012 Freedom Award, the 2012 Congressional Staffer of the Year Award, and the 2012 National Legislative Proponent Award. Wofford also served Majority Leader Harry Reid, running an in-house think tank for Democratic senators from 1993 to 1998. She was a policy advisor in the Clinton White House for Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Robert Reich, and has also worked on policy ideas for the Obama White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carrie Wofford.
Hi, thanks. Great to be here.
And I guess the question about today's Rose Garden ceremony, which is unprecedented in as much as the president laid down a marker in introducing three judges to the D.C. Court of Appeals, who've already Republicans have already filibustered a very qualified candidate twice prior to this. So the impression is that he's laying down a marker and basically challenging the Republicans not to filibuster these nominations. I guess my question would be, why has it taken so long?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think the key is how different the times are today than they used to be. So this has been a very long period of years here, about 5 years of the Senate Republicans blocking President Obama's judicial nominations and obstructing them, and it's unprecedented. So this is not how the Democrats treated President Bush's judicial nominations. It's not how President Clinton's were treated. It's not how President Reagan's were treated. This is not how we do business. But they have been, and I worked for Harry Reid for a while in the majority leader's viewpoint, you see that Republicans blocking on a party line vote perfectly reasonable mainstream judges, and that is just not how things were ever done before. So I think the president is trying to say, enough. Let's move these judges. The American people deserve to have their cases heard. This court, as you may know, the D.C. Circuit, handles the appeals of citizens' rights to appeal administrative rules. So when the EPA puts out rules on clean air or clean water, or the Labor Department puts out rules on workplace safety, this is the only place you get to go. So it's detrimental to the American people when they don't have enough judges to get their cases heard.
So the president basically said warned the Republicans not to play games, as if they haven't been playing games, and you have to admit quite successfully. If they've arbitrarily decided that in order to get anything passed in the Senate, you have to have 60 votes, then they basically shut down hundreds and hundreds of bills, my understanding. Tom Coburn alone has shut down over hundreds. And then the president is saying again today in the Rose Garden, when a Republican was president, 11 judges on the D.C. Circuit Court made complete sense. Now that a Democrat is president, it apparently doesn't. 8 is suddenly enough. And he's referring, of course, to the attempts on the part of the minority leader of the Judiciary Committee to basically change the rules and say, no, we, after all of this, we only need 8 judges. So, and of course, he's talking about packing the court with alluding to FDR. I mean,
right.
It's pretty...
I clerked on the D.C. Circuit when I was fresh out of Yale Law School, and I saw my judge fairly recently, who's currently one of the active judges on the D.C. Circuit, and I'm not going to name who it is, but my judge remarked on how desperate they are for judges to come in and take the cases. They're having to have retired judges work overtime to take these cases. The number of appeals per active judge has increased 38%. Since 2005, and nearly 50% from 2003. The Congressional Research Service, CRS, is a nonpartisan research entity of the government that the Congress can use to research information about bills. They recently put out a report saying that there has been a notable change in how judges are being blocked. A notable change. So there is something different going on.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, that not only have the Republicans gotten away with basically shutting down the Democrats who have the majority, and it really came to light in a very clear and present way with the NRA-sponsored attempts to shut down even modest attempts at reducing gun violence with something like a 90% majority of the American people, the will of 90% being thwarted by the minority. But my sense is that in framing this, what's behind this threat on the part of the president is that if you guys go ahead and filibuster these 3 nominations, then we're going to pull out the nuclear option, which is what is the idea of ending the filibuster through Senate rules implies. Why call it the nuclear option? And that's so apocalyptic. For God's sake, all they're doing is going back to how the Republic has operated for the last 200 years. So it's not a nuclear option. It's business as usual. It's the Republicans who have changed the rules and usurped power.
That's a great point. You're right. All they're seeking is a return to regular order. Regular order is the way Senate has always been. You're right. This is the filibustering of every single motion to proceed, which means you can't even start the debate, the filibustering of every judicial nominee, the filibustering of nominees, and then once we break the filibuster, they pass 98-0. I mean, why did we have to have a filibuster when it was going to pass 98-0? We saw that time and time again. You're right. It's just a return to regular order.
Well, then it sort of reminds me of the framing deficit that the Democrats have vis-a-vis the Republicans, that the scholar up at UC Berkeley, George Lakoff, argues about. Is it simply a poor framing to call it the nuclear option? Why don't the Democrats call it a restoration of American democracy and business as usual?
That's a great point. You should come up to Washington and come give us some advice. That's an excellent point.
There's enough pundits and pontificators in Washington. You don't need another one. So what's your sense then of this play on the part of the president? Because one of the things to remind our audience of, surely, Carrie Wofford here, is that the D.C. Court of Appeals, the very one that has these open seats, one of which has been open since 2005 when John Roberts went to the Supreme Court, they passed a ruling recently that essentially cuts off the president's attempt to get around the end run of the filibuster by doing recess appointments, which is the only recourse that he has. They've even voided or attempted to void his recess appointment. So he right. must know about it, surely. It must be getting kind of personal, isn't it?
Well, that's an excellent point. It quite possibly is personal. It's not entirely clear why there's this obstruction that hasn't ever happened before. I mean, the President Obama has twice the number of vacant judgeships as President Bush had. It's twice the number. So it's just but you're right. I think the reason the president is upping the ante is that he is anticipating obstruction. I spoke to some former colleagues in the Senate, and they do anticipate there will be obstruction on these three nominees. So I think the president is getting ready for that.
So will he, if the Republicans sort of sandbag him, would he then just agree, would he settle for the three if they decided to give him a break on the three but then return to filibustering as usual? I mean, isn't it really incumbent on the president and the Democrats to end this and to restore majority rule?
Yeah, we will have to see what happens. We don't know how the president is going to react after the obstruction and how the Democrats are going to react after yet more obstruction of regular order, especially when this is not how they treated President Bush's nominees. We don't know how they're going to react. I agree.
And again, I'm speaking with Carrie Wofford, who's a Democratic strategist with 20 years of policy and political experience from White House campaigns and senior Capitol Hill posts. And until 2013, she served Chairman Tom Harkin on the U.S. Senate Committee for Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions as senior committee counsel. She also worked for Majority Leader Harry Reid, running an in-house think tank for Democratic senators from 1993 to 1998. So to understand why Harry Reid and some of the younger Democratic senators for some time have been pushing him to change the rules so that the Republicans can't usurp power, as they have done for some time now, by the continuous use of the filibuster, the objections that I understand, as much as one learns about the negotiations that go on between the junior senators and the senior senators, is that The senior senators feel that if they were to change the rules, they may end up ruining the day if indeed the Republicans win a majority in 2014. And obviously, numerically, the Republicans have an advantage because there's a considerably more open Democratic Senate seats than there are Republican seats.
That's an excellent point. But don't forget that this last election cycle, the 2012, there was the same numeric disadvantage, and people thought that the Republicans might take control. I think, and by the way, I just wanted to clarify, from 93 to 98, I was with the Clinton White House. I was with Harry Reid much more recently. But I think you are correct. There is this sort of younger, more junior senators saying, hey, this is crazy. We shouldn't tolerate that. I will note that Tom Harkin, an old-timer, was also part of pushing for filibuster reform. And you're right. So far, Leader Reid has not wanted to – he's wanted to be respectful of the Republicans. He's such a decent human being that he doesn't – he's not trying to – he doesn't want to change the rules in a way that will further inflame partisan fires. So he wants things to be calmer, return to regular order. That's really what he's getting at. I think it's less about a fear of if we lose control. It's much more about let's return to being a gentlemanly institution. He doesn't want to have to change the rules. He feels like that's a slap in the face. So he's very much a respectful gentleman, and he just wants us to get back to that.
But didn't he make a gentlemanly deal with Mitch McConnell after younger senators like Jeff Merkley weighed in, and then McConnell turned around and slapped him in the face by filibustering Caitlin Halligan?
I agree. You're right. And that's they called it a gentleman's agreement, and the Republicans did seem to go right back on it right away. And Leader Reid shortly thereafter said on the floor that perhaps the people who are pushing for filibuster reform were correct, but he didn't go as far as to say he was ready to do it.
Well, you've described him as being gentlemanly, and you know him, you work for him. I understand he was also a former boxer, so how many times does he have to take it on the chin?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yes, he's a fighter, too, you are right, and he's a scrappy fighter. We just don't know what's going to happen. I think it's hard to predict. It'd be easy to, you know, hypothesize if the Republicans go too far this time, then the Democrats will surely change the rules. It's one thing I learned up there is there are 100 individual senators with different points of view, and it's hard to predict how they'll react.
Well, what about how the American people will react? I mean, there's an expression in this country that nice guys finish last. And as a Democratic strategist, are the Democrats in danger of just looking weak? Don't the people in this country want their leaders to be effective?
That's an excellent point. And I think that's why you've seen President Obama taking this case to the American public, just as he's been taking the gun control question to the American public, and just as he's taking immigration reform to the American public, and just as he's taking the student loan interest rate rise to the American public. He's saying, Americans, you need to make your voices heard. You need to call your senators and call your congressmen. And if they are voting or threatening to vote in ways that are completely at odds with the American public, you need to let them know. So I think he is trying to make this a broader conversation, get this beyond the beltway. It shouldn't just be a bunch of senators sitting in a room. It should be American people making their voices heard, and people can make their voices heard through Twitter and through emails and through phone calls. There's so many ways to make your voice heard today. And I think he's ready for Americans to get a little louder.
Well, what's at stake here, though, is something that's quite profound, is it not? And that is the future of the judiciary. And my understanding is that as a third branch of government, the judiciary is deeply slanted in favor of the Republicans. And I just spoke the other day to a recovering Republican, John Dean, who was President Nixon's counsel and obviously was famous for the Watergate hearings. He made the point that the Republicans have been putting in very mediocre judges, very ideological judges, and that most of the judges that have been filibustered, in fact, all of the judges that have been filibustered have been highly qualified. And it seems that by being so obstructionist, they've already moved the goalpost to the right because they're basically saying you can only put up moderate judges. I mean, there used to be liberals on the Supreme Court,
right.
William O. Douglas, for God's sake. And, you know, I mean, the goalposts have been moved, have they not?
They've been totally moved. I mean, the nominees who have been obstructed recently are so moderate and so mainstream that the liberals, you know, the liberal organizations have been complaining that they're too moderate and too mainstream. And even these very moderate and very mainstream judges we can't get through. And you also mentioned sort of the importance of this court. To share with your viewers, the D.C. Circuit is entrusted with interpreting so many laws that matter so much. The Americans with Disabilities Act, the Endangered Species Act, the Environmental Protection Agency, Clean Water, Clean Air, Superfund, Resource Conservation, the enemy combatants and terrorism and detention cases. I mean, this court matters. It's a unique circuit court with unique jurisdiction, and we've got to have judges on there. And these are very mainstream, very moderate, completely unobjectionable judges.
Well, just in closing, Carrie Wofford, what's your sense of what's going to happen? Do you think the president's daring the Republicans to go ahead and filibuster, go ahead and make my day type of thing? Will they? Do you think they will do it, or will they let him have these three judges and go back to business as usual? Or are we going to have a change here? Is this usurpation of power going to continue?
It's an excellent question. I don't think the president was so much as saying, make my day, I challenge, try and obstruct and see what happens. I think he's anticipating an obstruction, and I think the Democrats who I've spoken to in the Senate are anticipating obstruction. So people, the behind-the-door conversations that people have been having indicate that we are likely to see obstruction on these three.
Well, Carrie Wofford,
they are moderate and mainstream.
Well, Carrie Wofford, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carrie Wofford, who's a Democratic strategist with 20 years of policy and political experience from White House campaigns and senior Capitol Hill posts. Until 2013, she served Chairman Tom Harkin of the United States Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions as the senior committee counsel. She was awarded the 2012 Freedom Award, the 2012 Congressional Staffer of the Year Award, and the 2012 National Legislative Proponent Award. Wofford also served Majority Leader Harry Reid, running an in-house think tank for Democratic senators. And from 1993 to 1998, she was a policy advisor in the Clinton White House for Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Al Gore, and Robert Reich, and has also worked on policy ideas for the Obama White House. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.